Welcome, listeners, to Le Grand Bouffe, the big feast, with myself, Cole Smithy, and this week's special guest host, Mr. Bernard Feinsod, director, screenwriter, editor, man of all trades relating to film. Welcome, Bernard.
Thanks, Cole. You're too kind.
So you chose Guillermo del Toro's award-winning Shape of Water.
Absolutely, yeah. Incredible film set in 1960s Baltimore against the Civil War, a Cold War backdrop.
Uh-huh.
And touches on, you know, Latin America, inter-American relations in Latin America and colonialism and, you know, sort of the rape of the Amazon and the oil industries and biomedical research in Baltimore, though they shot it in Toronto.
Uh-huh. Well, we're going to dive into it. And you're from Baltimore, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so great. So there's going to be so much. It's going to be fun to hear your perspective on this great movie. But I did want to talk about the beer that I chose for us to drink.
100%.
Which it caught my eye for a number of reasons. A, it's from Stone. B, it's a double IPA. And then the name is Fear Movie Lions. Fear period, movie period. Lions double IPA, and of course there is a creature on their icon is a creature.
Oh, what a great monster beer.
So I thought that this would be an appropriate beer for us to imbibe. So cheers to the Stone Fear Movie Lions double IPA. Let's have a little taste of this drink.
Oh wow, it's the unfiltered double. Those are nicer. They got that nice grain to them.
Yeah, it's got a little sweetness to it. I like it. It's yummy. It's got it's got nice balance. All right, so let's get into this movie, which I don't know if you would classify it a fantasy or a magical realism film. I think it veers toward fantasy a little more than magical realism, but it's certainly full of social import. And beautifully shot, beautifully edited. We both just watched it again recently. I think just last night. And what really struck me about seeing it the second time is how just meticulously edited, beautifully edited the movie is. It moves so seamlessly.
Oh man, the perspective's incredible. I mean, right down to like some of the later transitions and stuff. There's this scene where Sally Hawkins is on the bus looking at the raindrops as the wind blows them
across
the window.
Oh, I love that scene.
And it sort of like uses this watery wipe to her feet walking through the lab that she cleans for a living.
Yeah. He uses water as a beautiful image system in the film. And I felt like he pushes toward overdoing it with the teals and the greens.
The color motif is super blue and green.
He
underwater.
Really goes for it. Yeah. But that said, I enjoy it. It's beautiful. It's really lush, and you can just it's a feast for the eyes.
But right down to the Jell-O that he's asked to change the Jell-O from red to green in the ad.
And Michael Shannon's character eats the little green candy, hard candies.
Yeah, I wonder if that's almost a joke about about the color motif that's built into the movie. It is kind of a fantasy. It's like a fairy tale. It's a love story. It's like a classic love story, like almost like a Casablanca sort of like unbridled love.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it extends across multiple genres. It has the old Cold War horror, sort of monster horror.
Sure. Yeah.
History.
And he very clearly is using Creature from the Black Lagoon as a touchstone.
100%. Yeah. And when he's Guillermo del Toro has spoken a lot about that.
Yeah.
As primary influence.
Yeah.
But he flips a lot of the tropes that are commonly used in those sorts of like unrequited love story fantasy horror movies. He flips them on their head, which I really enjoyed because you wind up seeing the same entities represented differently.
Yeah.
And it sort of is kind of a direct in your face to the sort of like propagandist nature of a lot of those films at their inception in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. and 70s even. And sort of like it takes what was formerly used to build fear in society,
mm-hmm.
and flips it on its head so that it's there to actually break down those forms of xenophobia and intolerance and othering, where like your antagonists are the ones who are othering,
yeah,
as opposed to your protagonists who are more all accepting.
I think it's interesting how he really uses these six main characters, and there are these dualities within the relationships. So there's this similarity of the relationship between is his name Giles?
Giles is the closeted gay roommate, right, played by Robert Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins?
Richard Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins, the great Richard Jenkins. And so you've got this this duality going on between Giles' relationship to the creature, and you've got this dual thing going on between Zelda and Eliza.
Yeah.
And so you've got these dueling characters, and then you've also got the power structure between the Russian guys and their scientist, and between the American military and Michael Shannon, their point guy.
Yeah, the Russian, the sort of like American CIA influenced military versus the Soviet spy. Absolutely, the parallels are real, and all of them are bridges,
mm-hmm.
for Eliza to these like other aspects of the world, because she's sort of isolated as a mute,
right?
So Giles and Zelda, or Delilah, as mm-hmm. Michael Shannon's character calls her, they're sort of like her bridge to the speaking world in a lot of ways,
and they're all outsiders.
100%, a black woman in Baltimore in the 60s. Yeah. In during the civil rights movement, and the closeted gay man in Baltimore who's in love with like the straight pie guy,
at the diner,
and the
creature,
and at and the creature, the monster, is obviously alone, which is loneliness is an incredible theme,
right,
throughout the film. And even the agents of state are lonely and isolated, because both of them come to understand that at the drop of a hat, they don't actually have the support of the state for which they work. They're on their own, and at the earliest signs of trouble, they'll be abandoned and even, you know, stricken down by their own systems that they're there to prop up. They're just pawns, and that's one of the most fascinating things about it, because it draws an amazing parallel between superpowers and the way they operate, and you know, country overall also means that if you're not doing your job to prop up the country, like, you're worthless to them.
Yeah, you're disposable.
And then that makes, you know, they're just as disposable as the subjugated peoples of the film, who are the main characters, the monster, Eliza, Zelda, Giles, are all painfully aware that there's something in society preventing them from being fully a part of it.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, each of them has that struggle. And you know, specifically for Zelda and Giles, they have the realization at a certain point that it would be less human to not support, Eliza in her sort of like mission of love than it would be to, you know, to stand back would be less human than to help her. And that plays into like buying into corporate expectations. Giles is an ad sales artist. He's a painter for doing mock-ups to sell Jell-O. And he's like also an outsider in that respect, because he was,
and who's the famous alcohol artist that did all the Americana stuff? It's in that vein. You know,
I don't know the name you're talking about, but it's an absolutely unmistakable look that gets replicated for, you know, people's billiards rooms.
Super super nostalgic, super Americana, super white.
Exactly. The nuclear family. What does the guy say? He tells Giles, make him smile bigger.
Yeah.
He's like, they're already super happy, man. Like, you can't make these people any happier. Make them happier.
Uh-huh.
Make the Jell-O greener.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think that the agents of state in the same way have their realizations, like, to little spoiler, but it's late enough for these.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But Michael Shannon's character kind of only comes to terms upon death. Whereas like the Dimitri or Dr. Hofstadler,
who's that actor?
What's his name?
He's done a lot of Coen Brothers stuff.
Yeah.
He's terrific. Great. He's so great.
He kind of comes to the realization earlier because he's asked by the lab to kill and crack open the creature, and the Russians want him to kill and dispose of it before the Americans can do the research. He's sort of like a vital character, like a vital representation of like in too deep and this isn't right. He has a crisis of faith in everything that he stands for.
Yeah.
And that really occurs for him in a major way, whereas Michael Shannon's crisis of faith is a kind of a crisis of faith in himself. Like, he just wants, like, when do I get to stop proving that I'm decent or good? And it's like, dude, you haven't proved that.
Right, exactly. You're neither of those things. And we learned that very clearly in his flirtations with Eliza, where he really tries to come on to her. And
That scene is grotesque.
It's so ugly. It's a very ugly scene.
Yeah, his fantasy is a demure woman who doesn't speak, who is completely subordinate.
Right.
And that sort of like toxic masculine narcissism plays out for him as his like primary drive for the entire film. It's the way he approaches his work. It's the way he approaches urinating.
Yeah, he wants to inflict pain and humiliate, and he's got that outrageous electric baton. What is that thing?
It's a cattle prod.
It's a cattle prod.
Yeah, he calls it an Alabama howdy do or something like that, and it's a representation of like Southern racism and Jim Crow,
right?
And like crowd management during civil rights era protests.
Right.
So, and it sort of touches on that a little bit in another scene where Richard Jenkins tells Sally Hawkins to flip to channel because she's watching civil rights protests on TV.
Right.
She's watching the news returns.
Yeah.
He says, change the channel.
Right.
And he would rather watch like Bojangles.
Right.
Which is like a complete flip. It's like, no, like go back to the minstrel era. And that's Richard Jenkins, like, His drive as a man is conflicted, where like he wants to be braver, he wants to be able to be himself, but he still exists in this society where he also recognizes himself as a white man, as someone who's capable of like blending in and fitting into that culture.
Right.
And at the
same time, he also has a tremendous amount of respect for the skill that it takes for that dancer to do those moves.
Yeah, yeah. But he compares him to the white dancer.
right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But that's also Shirley Temple.
Yeah.
Right? That's
yeah.
So that was like there's something very, you know, it's still the black guy that's teaching her how to dance. The cultural aspects of the film, a lot of the culture is drawn from subjugated communities or subjugated people. And that plays out musically a bit as well, I think. Alexander Desplat,
Alexander Desplat.
He did the score,
right?
And it's incredible.
Yeah,
it has a number of influences in film history and also just like symphonically or orchestrally.
Sure.
But it kind of like you can see the influence of black culture in the selections for who is watching which television show or at which given time.
Yeah.
There's like the whitewashed beat era show on Michael Shannon's family television on Strickland's TV that his kids are watching or that he's watching. And
right. In his perfect American dream home.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like one of
50s, early 60s era dream home.
It's completely sanitized.
Yeah.
And picket fence, breakfast table. That conversation that they have over the breakfast table is hilarious. The kids asking about the future, which is another huge theme. like futurism and posthumanism in this film.
Yeah, when the car salesman tells him that, you know, you're a man of the future.
Yeah, he buys it right away.
And there's all, and also the poster that Giles is working on, the title of that poster is something about, you know, the future is near.
The food of the future or something like that.
Yeah.
And then there's the kid asking Strickland about the jetpacks. He said, are we going to have jetpacks? And he's like, of course, this is America.
Right.
Which is like, it's pretty perfectly like a McFly moment almost. But he really buys into that America is the only future sort of like outlook.
Yeah.
Which is also a Cold War outlook, because they're the reason they've kidnapped the creature from the Amazon in what I guess might be Ecuador, based on the mentions of like oil drilling, because the CIA had operations in like basically a propped up Chevron in the Amazonian rainforest.
Oh yeah.
Around that time.
Yeah.
He kind of is alluding to the fact that like America is the only future. Like it's centrist mentality. It's sort of like the Cold War era space race. Like, we're going to beat these guys. And that's why they're doing the research.
Yeah.
Because of the dual breathing mechanism that the monster has. They're trying to figure out how to put men in space as opposed to a dog.
And they're using the biblical references the way that white people of that era love to do, and still love to do. Where, you know, it still happens. I the White House correspondent will quote, you know, that, you know, it's in the Bible, or, you know, and make a quote from the Bible. And so we get these Delilah associations from.
I mean, we were seeing parallels to that right now playing out with immigration.
Absolutely.
In the United States, like Jeff Sessions pops up at the podium, references the Bible, takes things out of context to suit his own meaning. But really, like, is propping up his own bigotry and xenophobia by misusing stories.
That's it.
And that's the rhetoric of, like, a manifest destiny United States. And
it just goes on and on and on. When will it ever end?
That's amazing.
It's a little stupefying that it still goes on, especially considering that I think that the number of atheists, the percentage of the population that are atheists is somewhere, I don't know, like over 50%. I did want to, like, we're looking at the sketches of the monster, and I did want to say, because I interviewed Guillermo del Toro for Pan's Labyrinth and Cannes, and he's quite an artist, and he designed the monster. So, you know, those sketches that are in the movie, that's his sketch.
Those are his charcoal sketches.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. I didn't even know that. I know he's an illustrator.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that he had done the monster
the
sketches
design.
Himself.
Yeah.
The ones that that are in the scientists are in Hostetler's notebook.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's really impressive that this movie stays true to the B movies of the 50s, in that they were all pretty much low budget films. And I can't remember how much he made this for. I think it was less than $15 million that he made this movie for.
Yeah. And less than 15, less than 20, I think, actually.
And that's a low budget movie. So this really is a classic. You could call it a classic sci-fi B movie, except that it's made to very high standard.
It's interesting that there was a great year for that sort of B movie turned A movie.
Uh-huh.
Like Get Out, I think, was the same year.
Uh-huh.
Which is also sort of like a horror B movie turned into a primary. This is a film now. This
right.
is a commentary on why B movies were.
Yeah.
What type of devices they had to offer.
I don't think Get Out stacks up anywhere near the stature of this film, though, I have to say.
The effects that they accomplished
and,
with the
and,
low
and also,
budget,
and also
amazing.
And also the story. I feel like the Get Out storyline, it has some pretty big weaknesses in it. But this thing, I feel like you could hammer nails in all day long. It's really solid. This story is very solid.
It covers such a broad spectrum. It's really incredible how many issues they were able to touch on. Del Toro sort of infused it with something for everybody.
Yeah, it's in the fabric of the story. Nothing's beating you on the head, but it's all there. And you get even from Zelda's character, when she talks about, she has a line about short men, how they'll always stab you in the back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get people's prejudices too.
Yeah.
And even the relationship between her husband, where her husband won't stand up for her when the chips come down.
Yeah, he sort of snitches.
Yeah, totally.
He absolutely snitches.
He does, yeah. And she really comes down on him. But, you know, so we get all of these character flaws, even in the people who, you know, ostensibly would be, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, they would typically be kept pure in a lesser filmmaker's hands. They would,
right.
They would be more stereotyped, but Del Toro allows everyone their flaws.
I think that's absolutely true. He really, he even allows for the most flawed characters to be folks you feel bad for, like at various points, which is in a similar way, an amazing strength of this film, where, like, you know, that moment where the general, the 5-star general, is bawling out Michael Shannon for losing the monster.
It's such a great scene.
It's an amazing speech.
It really is. He's so hardcore.
He tells him he's going to be in a world of shit in an alternate universe, like,
as a civilian.
Yeah, he says you're gonna be lost to civilization, or yeah, lost to being a civilian, essentially, which is like the worst thing that could happen is that you would be just another schmo.
Yeah.
And that's bullshit, first of all.
Of course it is. But that's the military ideal. And that, you know,
exactly.
And that's what I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about how the military always eats its own, but because people are such natural followers. You know, there's that Lou Reed song where he says, you know, the first thing that comes along that allows you the right to be, you follow it. You know,
yeah,
you know, it's called bad luck. And and I just think that that's, you know, that's it, it's so ingrained. And now I think in this country more than ever, this knee-jerk tendency towards conformity. When I was growing up, I was born in 63, and so I caught the last few months of the Kennedy administration.
Well, that's like I think this is set in basically 1963, 64.
Is that right? Okay.
So it's right at the end of the Kennedy administration. The Cuban Missile Crisis is cited in the film, so it had to happen after 62.
Oh, interesting.
Because the general mentions the Cuban Missile Crisis when he's talking about the space race.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
So it's actually maybe set the year you were born.
And so I remember the hippies and all the civil rights struggles that were going on and coming out of Watergate in the 70s. And there was this real sense that everyone was hip and in a cool way, and everybody knew, you know, to fight the system. That was the thing that was like everybody who was cool, and there were like everyone was cool, and so, you know, the going, you know, thinking on the street was correct. It was, I'm not saying that it was politically correct. I'm saying just the opposite. And then you have these
urban centers where that was like a melting pot for,
and I'm sure it was that way, you know. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and I'm sure it was that way in Baltimore. You know, that was the sensibility on the street. And but now all of that has changed into this whole other thing. I don't even know what it is, but you look at movies like Lady Bird, which I had to see twice before I realized what a toxic movie about conformity that film is.
It struck me as such when I heard that there was a Dave Matthews song featured prominently in it, but I actually didn't see Lady Bird.
Bingo.
Because I was like kind of worried about
that. You hit the nail on the head there.
I self-censored myself from seeing that one.
Yeah, you did the right thing. No, I mean, she's a bad person. She's a racist and a homophobe, and her goal, even though she colors her hair pink or whatever color it is, that's not who she is. That's not what she's after. Mm. She's totally in the race to the bottom. She wants to just fit in. She wants to be the ultimate conformist. And I feel like that's where people's heads are at these days in this country.
That's a huge part of it. And I think that, like, regardless of which side you're picking that you want to fit in with, there's a lot of people who are just trying to fit in, regardless of whether you're on the right or the left, or you're moderate, or there's some sort of thing to latch on to that's like a, whether it's a centrist movement or a leftist movement. And it's, you know, there's also the right side of history. So, I mean, I would rather latch onto that.
Exactly. Sure.
But people manipulate that, you know, you have all sides talking about what the right side of history is.
Exactly.
And it means something different to everybody.
Yeah. And reinventing history constantly. Mm-hmm. And you see that in textbooks and, you know, what's taught in schools.
Oh man. You know, I wonder what the same history textbooks that I would have been fed would be now, if they're different or the same. You know, what rewriting of history has occurred just in the last 13 or 14 years since I was
everything is an indoctrination. And and what I really love about film, and one of the things that keeps me going as a film critic and that really started me off, was I have this book by John Coble. It's the Top 100 Movies. And he surveyed 80 different filmmakers and critics and got their top 10 movies and distilled down from that list the top 100 movies. And so when I got out of college, I started going to the public library and taking them all out and watching them all. And what I quickly came to realize, you know, when you're watching The Great Dictator up against Andrei, you know, what's the Russian film? I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, the point is you see this humanitarian thread that runs through everything. And this movie fits right into that category where, and I think that's the beauty of global cinema, is that it carries this thread of humanitarian values that's very strong. And I would see a movie like Lady Bird flies in the face of that. It's not of that ilk. And so it's, you know,
it's fascinating.
If you know, you know, if you know what you're looking at, you can easily reject that film. Mm. And when you look at a lot of the superhero films, I think that those movies too fly in the face of that, because they're just about spectacle. And
yeah, I think and
they're
spectacle.
and they're promoting violence, because that's what they're feeding off of, and that's what they're promoting is military violence.
Yeah, there's countless. I mean, it is like a secret service sort of thing. As soon as the superheroes start getting indoctrinated into government service, there's like actually that Civil War. Like, I think it's, what was that Marvel movie, Civil War, about Captain America and Iron Man's like internal war amongst themselves about whether or not they should be there to serve country or humanity. And I think that's actually, oddly enough, a common theme in more sophisticated films, and they deal with it better. But a lot of what the comic books do is boil down those sorts of themes to being more black and white than they actually are. But I mean, like even in those, you have like Civil War theme. I mean, and the superheroes live for, so you're a superhero for like 50 years before you die somehow. So you've got Captain America as like this 80-year-old dude, but he's 25, you know, like, in Shape of Water, there's an element of that where the conformism is what the minority characters are fighting against. So Eliza knows she doesn't fit in, and she feels like the monster is the only one to see her for who she is without seeing what's missing. Whereas any other person would look at her and be like, well, she doesn't talk.
Right.
And that's what's missing.
One thing that I noticed this time around that I don't know if I really caught the first time was the Audrey Hepburn reference, how what's his name? Giles. How Giles? He, you know, he's got the TV Guide with Audrey Hepburn on the cover.
Oh yeah.
And then he's got he's doing a portrait of Audrey Hepburn, and that's just for him.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear that he makes that association between Audrey Hepburn and Eliza.
100%.
And that's really cool, because Eliza, she might be a little homely, but she has that same femininity. She has that same romantic spirit.
Oh, she's absolutely beautiful. And that's, I think, a big part of why they cast Sally Hawkins.
Sally Hawkins was so great. She's so terrific.
Yeah, and I think I heard Del Toro talked about that in his press junket, like interviews, and I think he said essentially, like, I'm going to be poorly paraphrasing, but
yeah,
He said basically, like, he selected her because he needed a beautiful woman who was not someone who you would want to obtain, mm-hmm. but someone who you couldn't help but fall in love with.
Mm.
And that's a very different type of beauty, mm-hmm. where, and then it plays out in terms of the narrative. She's an object to Strickland, Michael Shannon's character,
right.
but she's a natural beauty to the representation of the organic divinity, which is the monster.
There you go.
And that's like there's a heavy environmentalist bent to this movie.
For sure.
It's like an undertone.
Definitely.
Where you're sort of like dealing with advancement of sciences for human gain in the face of what's best for nature. And it kind of hint at it a lot over and over again, but it's not in your face, you know?
But it's very clear that they just want to kill the creature, and that tells you everything you want to know. Like, their only interest is in killing the thing.
Yeah, from only 45 minutes into the film or something, you know that they're out to kill this thing.
Have you seen Happy Go Lucky? Do you know that film?
I haven't seen it, no.
It's
really great,
and that's the first thing that I ever saw Sally Hawkins in. She's so terrific in that movie. I can't remember if it's a Ken Loach movie, maybe. I can't remember the British director who made it, but it's but that's how I discovered her, and I just think it's great that
I'm gonna have to add that one to my list.
Yeah, put that one on your list.
Yeah,
that Del Toro used her because she has such a magnetic quality about her.
Oh man, the to touch back on the issues of conformism.
Yeah,
that's like the Giles character who he's. It's his recognition of his own loneliness when he goes to try to repitch his new green Jell-O painting.
Right.
And comes back to Sally Field, which is actually the scene on on screen right now.
Uh-huh.
He essentially says to her, "I'm alone. You're the only one I have."
Yeah.
And in that moment, he strips himself of his corporate affiliations.
Right.
And I think like the late capitalism themes are prevalent in sort of the transformation of all of the supporting cast members who are kind of on her side.
Yeah.
And Zelda does the same thing where she's kind of like suddenly realizes that she says she's a bad liar. She almost threatens to out Eliza for kidnapping or freeing the monster. And in her moment in the interrogation, when she says like, no, she said thank you when Sally Hawkins is signing, excuse me,
it's okay,
when Sally Hawkins is signing fuck you at Michael Shannon,
yeah,
she covers up for her. And in that moment you're like, oh, she's stripping herself of her corporate affiliations and picking a side. And the corporate affiliations represent a masculine white world.
Yeah.
For everybody.
Yeah.
So each of these characters is struggling against the same machine.
It's a pretty outrageous thing that Eliza does when she signs fuck you to Michael Shannon, because regardless of whether he knows sign language or not, it's all on her face.
Yeah.
And it's pretty ballsy. You know, she's really just, she doesn't give a flying fuck. She's just going to.
She's like blank, though. It's not like an aggressive.
No, it's not aggressive.
Until like the fourth time she does it.
But it's very centered.
It's
She's completely defiant. Yeah, very defiant.
That's an amazing moment, and it's her opportunity to sort of like let him have it for the way he treats everybody. You know?
Well,
like,
and it's also an interesting, subtle commentary on the power of silence, because even though she can't speak, that makes her more likely to take action.
Mm.
And so rather than somebody who would talk about their ideas or their plans or their schemes or anything, she's put in a position where for her there's none of that. She's gonna take action.
She's an operative at that point.
She is.
And he, as another operative, recognizes his loss of power in that moment because something is happening that he's incapable of understanding. And that's also a theme throughout the movie, is just knowledge. And the monster is a representation of the furthering of knowledge. To what ends is really the question. For Sally Hawkins or Giles or Zelda or Dimitri, you know, they're coming to terms with their desire to know more about life or some greater truth, while the knowledge the government agents are after is, you know, it only pertains to the Cold War. Space race.
Right.
And even the Russian general equivalent, he tells Dmitri, like, look, kill this thing. We don't care about learning. We care about our enemies not learning.
Right. Like, right.
That's more important. And that's an example of what plays out these cycles of repeated government infraction on human living.
Well, there's a great microcosmic metaphor at play with Michael Shannon's fingers, that the
rotting
that
fingers.
The creature, i.e. nature, has bitten off two of his fingers, and they try and reattach them, and throughout the film they're turning black. And eventually he has to rip them off himself. And I think that's just a very not so subtle microcosmic metaphor for Mother Nature and how science and people, you know, the military who are going to take advantage of it, it's going to rot. Mm-hmm. And it's all, you know, and it's going to fall off.
And nature is its own cure. You know, like our organic divinity god monster is running around healing people left and right. He brings Sally Hawkins back to life,
except for the poor cat. But there has to be a casualty.
There were like five other cats. They'll that's be, right. Yeah. They got enough cats.
Yeah, he had more than one. That's a good point. He did have more than he had a few.
That's to make it up to PETA. but you know, like he brings the monster, gives Giles his hair back.
Yeah,
when he heals his arm.
Right.
There's multiple iterations. He self-heals when he gets shot to death.
Yeah.
And
I love what he does, what Del Toro does with that iridescent blue on the monster's skin.
It's like a bioluminescent.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. When I was in college at Evergreen in Olympia, Washington,
uh-huh.
we had a beach, and there would be like bioluminescent bacteria at night. And
wow.
If you ran your hand through the water, you could see like the bioluminescence shining. But like that's a miracle of marine biology and nature that is nothing but pure splendor.
Absolutely.
And if you've ever seen it in person, it's what they built into the creature, which
it's just mesmerizing.
That was an advanced piece of creating a character that's not human. I mean, the Blue Lagoon monster is laughably lo-fi.
Black Lagoon.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
Blue Lagoon. That's the one with the teen sex movie.
Yeah, the monster from the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah,
is it's not Brooke Shields.
No.
It's laughably lo-fi old B horror sort of stuff.
Yep,
and this is like,
but again, there's the love story in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
100%. In a King Kong sort of way,
Absolutely.
Or like a, you know,
and
like the scene where the monster swims under, was it Julie Andrews? This monster though has like a super hi-fi.
I love how the eyes blink from side to side.
Oh yeah, in like a very reptilian sort of way.
Yeah, very reptilian.
Yeah, and the like. Just the general, it's sort of like a slit. It's like a sports car version, you know. He's got like
for
the six
sure.
pack. He's got
oh, yeah.
the muscles, you know. Like it's kind of like you're looking at like
he's very tall
alpha creature of its own,
absolutely
of its own kind, which you don't know. It seems like it's one of a kind, but you don't totally know. They kind of hint that maybe this is like the last one or the only one.
And Michael Shannon does have that realization at the very end that the creature really is a god.
Yeah, when he cuts his throat, yeah.
yeah,
and he
right.
shoots it like five times, yeah. He just gets up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a powerful moment of realization where even you kind of feel for Michael Shannon even though you hate him.
Yeah.
Cuz you're like, well, you're not going to win this one. And you're either going to die doing this, or when you fail, the government is going to ruin the rest of your life, which is like this general is going to strip you of your title. You're not going to be a colonel anymore. You're not going to have a future in the military. You're going to have to get a job as a milkman.
You're going to lose your family, probably. You know, you're going to get divorced. There's going to be all sorts of hell to pay.
Yeah, it was pretty pronounced. So you kind of like, you're like, oh, you're just a helpless pawn too. You kind of feel for him from like a more meta perspective.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, man, you didn't have to play into the system. This was your choice.
Well, and see, and now we're back to that thing that I was talking about earlier where, you know, and then of course, you know, punk rock came along and, you know, songs like, you know, Career Opportunity, Was It Never Knock? I mean, you know, how could you live through the punk era as I did and come away giving any thought to signing on for any kind of
service
or yeah. any of that caca.
That's stuff I never considered in my life.
Exactly.
And it's largely based on just the knowledge that really when you sign that dotted line, you're signing your life away. You're also signing something that says that no matter what you believe in, you're just going to do what you're told. And to me, that's the antithesis of freedom.
And it was one of my early lessons in the fallacy of the Democratic Party, because it was Jimmy Carter who reinstated the draft when I was at that age. And I just, oh, man, I would have done, there's no way I would have left the country. I would not have gone into any kind of military service under any circumstances.
These aren't my wars, you know. Like, it's disappointing,
you know,
to watch cycles play out.
And you know, now we've moved into this, as everything seems to do, we've moved into all corporatized ideology just feeds into endless war. And we've been at war for as long as any millennial can remember.
I mean, for me, I was in 2001, after 9/11, I think I was in Italy. Really, the year after, whenever Shock and Awe was 2008, 2009. So I was abroad visiting my brother. It wasn't even that late. It was like 2003?
Yeah.
Shock
and Awe was earlier.
Yeah, it was like 2003, I think. I was visiting my brother in Italy and watching the bombings happen live on television. And you could see like the missile flares and everything. And and I realized, like, you know, that was going to be the foreseeable future at that time. And I was growing my first beard. I was like 14 years old, 13 or 14 years old or something. I was growing my first beard, and my brother and his friends and I all struck a deal that none of us would shave until the war was over.
Wow. And
none of us have upheld that deal, obviously, because if we had upheld it, yeah, I would have a beard down to my knees and I'd still be growing it right now. But it's endless, you know, like, and that's the endless war that is predicted in so many sci-fi dystopian novels and things like that. And it's present, the endless war that's present in Shape of Water. The Cold War has resurfaced now. So this thing that was already quote unquote over is playing out now globally in a whole new way. There are proxy wars in Africa, in the Middle East, all over the world.
Everywhere.
And it's actually just, I mean, it makes you wonder, these times of prosperity and peace are just sort of like also a construct.
Well, it's cash through chaos. You break it and then you hire the contractors to come in to fix it, knowing that they never will. It's just a way of creating more demand. You just want to constantly be creating more demand.
If you can destroy enough, you're forced to create in response to that.
Yeah, so but with no pretense that you're really fixing anything.
That's very true. There's a pretense, or there's a pretext that you're probably not going to fix anything.
Well, that's and so it's a given. So when the companies that you're paying billions of dollars to aren't able to follow through on whatever the contract said they would do, oh well, they got paid.
Yeah.
What are you going to do now?
Just more counterinsurgencies and things like that. Well, that's interesting, because one of the aspects of this film that I think is like an underwriting current, and also it's really upfront. But it's the cultural exchange between different parties from different backgrounds, as opposed to, you know, like forcing the monster to conform to the human world, there's this sort of like invitation from Sally Hawkins. And that's like, I'm going to teach you the language I speak. We're going to listen to some albums together. We're going to, you're going to discover the wonder of the cinema in that beautiful Elgin movie theater in Toronto, which is based on the Senator in Baltimore. Which is like a beautiful historic theater that's been saved multiple times by the city from becoming whatever, like a Target.
So did you want to talk about the military industrial complex around Baltimore?
A little bit. That would be great, actually. Cause I was listening to some other podcasts or other, I was reading around and I was listening to the Slate podcast or some others. And it seemed like maybe there's this notion that there's no military industrial complex in Baltimore or there's no government facilities, but there's kind of a pretty striking and well-documented history of biomedical research facilities in the greater Baltimore area. Just outside Baltimore, about 30 minutes north or a little bit further, is Aberdeen Proving Grounds, which is a well-known like biomedical research facility where, especially during the Cold War era, a lot of chemical warfare and weaponization of disease type research was being done. And in Frederick, Maryland, about 45 minutes to an hour out as well, is Fort Detrick, which is known for the same. So it was a hotbed for that type of research. They would set it in the country just outside the city so that if anything went wrong, it was sort of, they could pretend it didn't happen. It's sort of off to the side. In the film, I think for convenience, the research facility is more set in the city, kind of in the city by the sea sort of sense, like in the opening voiceovers, or like there's a, you know, it's a city where there's nothing else, just the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it is that, that's a lie. And it's an open lie that I think Del Toro wants it to be a lie. It's like, mm-hmm. this is actually a cultured city
mm-hmm.
with problems
mm-hmm.
and it's trying to work itself out.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who live in the city speak for themselves. You have art and film enthusiasts, hardworking people who are struggling for rights. And you also have like this sort of vapid false culture of the future of corporate America, and it's being sold right down the pipeline by everybody who you learn to hate throughout the course of the film. Mm-hmm. There's this pie salesman who's from Ottawa. He talks with a Southern accent and pretends to be a Southern American. Baltimore is just below the Mason-Dixon line. So it's the South, but it was in the Union during the Civil War. So it's sort of this conflicting thing there that actually like exists in the film. You know, that guy's, he's a homey sort of like, Southern host, but at the same time, it's all a front. And I think that speaks to sort of the front of Southern hospitality.
I was just going to say, it's because I'm from Richmond, which was, as everyone knows, was the capital of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And yeah, that whole kill them with kindness thing. It's, believe me, it's all about the killing, not the kindness.
Yeah, the minute somebody's out of the room, the next comment comes out of the mouth, and it's not all sweet-toothed and...
No. It's really... I just find it a reprehensible trait of the South, and it's pervasive. Still pervasive.
I think the South is awesome. Like, I think there's a lot of beautiful cultural, heritages in the South of America, like... Not just dishing the South,
right? Sure.
But I am convinced that the two-facedness of our society is represented very clearly in the adoption of the false accent in this film.
Absolutely,
that's like,
and that's another really meaningful scene. It's not overplayed. Everything that Del Toro, it's such a beautifully written movie because there's just so much economy throughout. Nothing is overstated. Nothing is overplayed. The suspense, there's layers of suspense that build, but even that's not overplayed.
100%.
Because it's a romance story. It's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the theme. That's the overriding theme.
Yeah, it's about the love and the lack of love.
Yeah.
And a lot of the love story is so bold because of how much plays out where characters want love,
yeah,
but it's not there for them.
Yeah, and Octavia Spencer's character, Zelda, is in a pretty loveless marriage,
mm-hmm.
and that act of betrayal that the husband commits, you think his name is Bruce, but it's really Brewster.
Brewster, yeah.
As you find out.
Yeah, Brewster, yeah.
But Brewster is not a man of integrity.
No, he's not really, he's kind of just a hardworking, lazy guy who does his job and comes home and wants to be taken care of by his subordinate.
And doesn't
wife.
Say anything. So in a way, he's a mirror of Michael Shannon's character.
Yes.
He's a black mirror of Michael Shannon's character. Michael Shannon, who thinks of himself as being a decent human being, but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who, presumably because he's married to this clearly a woman of morals, you know, so you would presume that he would share those, but no, it doesn't.
And in the similar, you were talking about the parallel characters too.
Yeah,
In the similar sense, Zelda and Giles are deeply linked, and there's a couple moments where they really like drive that home. And one is the moment where Brewster is not much of a husband to Zelda, and he's ready to turn her in.
Yeah.
And another is the moment where Giles sees, as he's getting kicked out of the pie shop, sees the same false accented Ottoman kick out the black couple in
right.
a really mean way.
Yeah.
And the two, in that moment, he realizes that he doesn't want to be that. And
yeah.
all of the Bojangles watching and all of his
right.
sort of like internal conflict of like what keeps him closeted, he kind of in that moment is like, oh.
Yeah. And he speaks up.
Yeah. He speaks up and then he wipes his. He takes the napkin yeah. and go like puts it in his mouth and scrapes the pie off of his tongue instead
yeah.
of just like spitting it out. He's like,
he wants to get all of it off of him.
Yeah, it's like that moment is the moment he purges himself
right.
of all of the falsehood that
yeah.
he's bought into
yeah.
that has kept him from being himself.
And there's so I mean, that's such a great scene, and you really, it's not overstated, but you really you get it. You understand exactly what that means, exactly what that action is accomplishing,
mm-hmm.
and there's just so many layers to this movie that really add up. Everything adds up.
Oh, it's incredible.
And that's, you know, I know that there's, you know, some audiences have an aversion to fantasy or magical realism, but what I think about that is when it's in a social context, which is, you know, like the Milagro Beanfield, whatever, that's another that's Robert Redford's, you know, magical realism
thing. Yeah,
very leftist ideology behind that. This is actually a very leftist film too, and as much as leftist is a dirty word, it remains a dirty word, and there's really, I don't think there's a single news outlet in the country that truly represents any leftist ideals at all. I think that anytime the meter starts to go a little bit left, it's killed off. But what I think is that you realize that if you know about the history of bossa nova music, for example, that in Brazil, bossa nova was a leftist movement. It came out of this ideology that was inspired by the Beats, and so it was this really focused leftist ideology, and that's in this movie too, and that's really cool to me. I really like that.
They really did a good job of representing just any aspect of a modern society that is disenfranchised, and like right down to the monster itself, which represents like whether it's earth, religion, any sort of divinity, otherness, immigration. It's a kidnapped. It's been kidnapped. It comes to the United States involuntarily, which is really important because most people who are leaving their country to come here aren't leaving because they want to come here first and foremost. A lot of the time it's because they want to leave where they are.
Absolutely.
And that's important to distinguish.
Yeah.
And I think that like in this film, there's a whole lot of, you know, pushing forward of people who are trying to get out of their lives or to recreate their lives if they could. Even, you know, Dimitri's trying to be extracted. He wants out. He's done. He's no longer. He's I get my safe house. I get to go live the rest of my life. I've done my service. And they're like, no, you're just going to die. And it speaks to how hard it is to break free of the structures that confine us. I think like the monster's sort of vision of post-human life is one where people don't know the traits that define humanity. They're trying to establish throughout the film that what are the traits that define humanity? Is it the ability to communicate? Is it the ability to be emotional? Is it the ability to understand language, or to identify with culture like music or movies? And I think that like what it winds up being discovered is that it's an ethic, and it's how you deal with othering or the other that defines humanity. So the theme there is sort of which is central to who is quote unquote a good guy or a bad guy in this film. By the end of the story, is that it's less human to dehumanize than to humanize, and
that's well put.
It's not a it's not necessarily the monster that is the monster.
Oh right, of course.
The monster is a society that is unmoving and unmoved.
Yeah.
By the miraculous. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to also why I think fantasy is like a powerful genre. I would put this film in a sort of a genreless category almost. Uh-huh. It's got elements of all of that sci-fi, fantasy, yeah, horror. It's a love story. It's really like a Romeo, Juliet, Beauty and the Beast, like,
yep, all that stuff.
It doesn't I think that's why it rose to the surface and sort of beat the pack and won Best Picture, is because it didn't, if it could have been put in a box more easily and didn't have so many pieces for so many things in society that are interconnected but also isolated unto themselves, whether it's war, what is human, racism, homophobia, gender issues, science versus nature, or how can science support nature and prop it up versus how is nature used as a resource for science, and science only is for human beings. It's not, exploitive, exactly. Mm-hmm. So like those sorts of themes really prop the movie up for me as a film that recognizes where our society is now by pointing to the 60s. Like it's essentially says we've gone nowhere. Even the general character says, have we learned nothing? Like, he's right. It's not a question though. We haven't learned anything.
Yeah. It's totally rhetorical.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. I love it. Well, I want to thank you so much, Bernard, for coming on Le Grand Bouffe.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm sorry to chew your ear off, but
no. Listen, we have listeners in Munich and Ottawa and Turkey and the Arab Emirates, all over the place, in France. So, I think that probably they like to have their ears chewed a little bit.
I appreciate it a lot. Just a quick note, if any listeners want to continue to hear from me, or I'm on Twitter. I have a Twitter. It's at Bernard Feinsod, and an Instagram. It's at Bernard. It's a jumbled up version of my name. That's at BERNRD.
Spell it one more time.
BERNRD.
There you go.
Yeah. Just jumble up Bernard a few times. You'll find it.
Okay. All right. And, of course, I always want to encourage our listeners to please help support Le Grand Bouffe, The Big Feast, through Patreon. Just $5 or $10 a month can really help us keep the podcast going and make you part of the community. There's rewards on Patreon that bring you to the table that we share these great craft beers and films. And, of course, I want to encourage everyone to turn your cell phones off as much as possible, but certainly while you're walking, driving, riding a bicycle, or watching a movie. Le Grand Bouffe, The Big Feast is a production of Smart New Media.